From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Arnold the Action Hero became governor-elect of the state of California. And despite pre-election polls that predicted an easy win for Arnold, it seems like many members of the media could not quite believe what they were reporting. On national news outlets across the nation, the media's incredulity was audible.
Vote yes on the recall, yes for Arnold, and yes for the people of California.
Governor Schwarzenegger.
And your name, please?
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Will it be close?
6 months ago, it seemed impossible.
Well, we don't know. It is up to the God now. It's up to God of what the decision is.
Now, with the polls closed after a heavy voter turnout, the impossible has become inevitable.
Impossible to whom? Certainly not to Schwarzenegger, and apparently not to Harper's Magazine editor Lewis Lapham. In his Harper's Magazine column this month, Lapham looks askance at the Eastern elites who were shocked by Arnold's presumption, citing three contributors to the New York Times who noted that California wallowed in mindless ego, and where were the ropes of leadership with which to drag the animal back to the high and solid ground of the shining city on the hill? Lewis, welcome to On the Media.
I'm glad to be here, Brooke.
So in the run-up to the recall election, story after story hung on hanging chads, creating the illusion of a close race. Do you think that's because the media wanted it to be a close race, that they couldn't quite accept that Californians were backing the kindergarten cop?
I think that's certainly part of it. The media always want a close race. But I think they also got caught short because they still imagine themselves to be living in a world dependent on the meaning of words.
What do you mean?
This is the McLuhan argument. With print, you have sequence, narrative, hierarchy, classification, all of the categories dear to Ted Koppel and the Eastern media elites. They want to think of television as simply a more advanced form of print journalism. But the television appeals to the emotions and to the image. There is no necessary sequence. I mean, we live in a world where, with our clicker, we could see the President of the United States at any one time being played by George Bush, Anthony Hopkins, Harrison Ford, and so on. And in that world, it's the image that matters, not the language.
Aren't you selling the public a little short here? They can tell the difference between an actor playing a president and an actual president?
I don't know. If you look at the California vote, 60% of the people who voted for Schwarzenegger had no idea what he stood for. They didn't care. They voted for an image.
In the coverage of the recall, there was a lot of only in California commentary. Only in California would an action movie star be a serious contender for governor and face off with a has-been sitcom actor and a porn star. But is California really the alternate universe that some of the media portray it to be?
I don't think so. You could make the argument that California is the most American of states and atmospheres. When McLuhan is talking about the world of the electronic media and the sensibility, he refers to the pool of Narcissus. You have in Schwarzenegger, godlike narcissist. And that, of course, is a lot of the culture of California, and it's a lot of the culture of the electronic media. And I think that the journalists who like to think of themselves as statesmen and philosophers are reluctant to think that we are maybe coming away from the years of the Enlightenment into a more primitive set of arrangements.
I don't know. To me, you sound like a member of the hand-wringing Eastern media elite.
I hope I don't. I'm just describing what is happening.
What are your predictions on how the media will cover Governor Schwarzenegger?
Well, I think that they will try to paint him as a barbarian. You know, Attila has just sacked Rome. I'm sorry, not Attila, Alaric. On the other hand, they may adore him. They may say, we have seen the truth.
The news media are always being charged with becoming more and more like entertainment, of pandering to the people. And yet, when it comes to Arnold Schwarzenegger, they seem to get on their high horse. Are the news media mad at Arnold for laying the device bare?
Yes, I think so, because it detracts from their own self-importance. My God, if a bodybuilding actor can become governor of California, then what happens to all the wisdom of our Sunday morning sermons? Politics is a great mystery, which only the initiates can truly understand. They, the high viziers of the media, being the ones who understand the mystery. And then if it suddenly turns out to be less of a mystery and more of a circus, what is diminished is the sense of their own self-importance.
Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Lewis Lapham is the editor of Harper's Magazine and writes the Notebook column every month.
It has been largely unnoted this week that Schwarzenegger's election means so-called liberal Hollywood has produced yet another Republican officeholder. In fact, though the acting community is viewed as almost monolithically on the political left, history shows that Republican thespians perform much better, as candidates anyway, than their Democratic colleagues. On the Media's John Solomon explains why.
California State Senator Sheila Kuehl is one of the nation's few openly lesbian elected officials. But she is a member of an even rarer political minority group, former actors who have been voted to office as Democrats. Kuehl, who played Zelda Gilroy on the early 60s TV series The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, is only the third such Democrat elected in modern American history. Previously, theater actress Helen Gehagen Douglas was sent to Congress from Los Angeles in 1944. Ben Jones, Cooter on The Dukes of Hazzard, represented a suburban Atlanta district in the U.S. House from 1988 to 1992. Yet beginning with song and dance man George Murphy, who was elected to the U.S. Senate from California in 1964, the Republican Party has fielded a larger cast of elected performers. Ronald Reagan followed in Murphy's footsteps, going from winning one for the Gipper to winning more than one for the GOP. In 1986, Fred Grandy left the Love Boat to go to Congress. Sonny Bono joined him there in 1994. Clint Eastwood successfully ran for mayor of Carmel, California. And Fred Thompson just finished serving 8 years in the U.S. Senate before returning to acting as, ironically, an elected district attorney on NBC's Law & Order. Sheila Kuehl suggests one reason for the Republican advantage is that Democratic actors need to build a political resume before party leaders and voters feel they are qualified for office.
Whereas many Republican candidates who get elected can be more personalities or simply anti-government. And sometimes a lack of experience is considered a plus in a Republican campaign. One is thought to be, you know, fresh and unspoiled, as it were.
Geography is another explanation, according to Ron Brownstein, author of The Power and the Glitter, which examines the relationship between Hollywood and Washington. Democratic actors working and living in Los Angeles and New York often find their ambitions blocked by the lines of Democratic politicians also interested in running, and there are not many places in the middle of the country where a liberal Democratic actor can realistically win, because they can be tarred with Hollywood's culturally decadent reputation. Ron Brownstein.
It may be a little easier for the Republicans than the Democrats to make the jump, and it's for a good Hollywood reason, and that it's playing against type.
Also politically damaging to liberal celebrities is that activism on the coasts can make them appear more extremist in the heartland, even among moderate Democratic voters. That's according to the Dukes of Hazzard's Ben Jones, the only former actor elected as a Democrat outside of Los Angeles.
The nature of the issues around Screen Actors Guild politics and things like that sort of push these folks to the left, to not a moderate or centrist Democratic Party viewpoint, but on the left fringe. Warren Beatty and Barbara Streisand, people who are always talking about running for president and have high political profiles, couldn't get elected dog catcher in this neck of the woods in Virginia.
Most Democratic actors who have run recently have lost decisively. Ralph Waite, Pa in The Waltons, was soundly defeated by Sonny Bono. Actor Barry Gordon, also a former SAG president, lost a California congressional race in 1998. Nancy Culp, banker Jane Hathaway on the Beverly Hillbillies, tried unsuccessfully for Congress from Pennsylvania. It didn't help that co-star Buddy Ebsen campaigned for her GOP opponent. It is likely that the Republicans will continue to recruit in Hollywood. Democrats, on the other hand, have actively solicited celebrities' financial resources and public support, but the party has not made as much of an effort to sign them up as candidates. Sheila Kuehl.
It would be a useful thing for the party to think seriously about who might be a good candidate and begin to speak to them.
Kuehl nominates Tom Hanks and Martin Sheen as actors warranting special attention. Indeed, that could be the problem. It may be that the most politically attractive Democrats have been having too much success to change careers. Until Schwarzenegger, there had not been an actor who turned to the ballot box while still really thriving at the box office. In fact, after Ronald Reagan became governor of California, movie director William Wyler remarked to a Democratic colleague, "If we had only given him a couple of good parts, he'd never be in Sacramento now." But Schwarzenegger has bucked that trend and proved as popular at the polls as he is on the big screen. Perhaps that will spur other popular actors to change roles as well. That is, if Martin Sheen is willing to accept a demotion to senator. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
With actors taking over states and political chat shows to weigh in on foreign policy, some politicians and pundits may resent encroachments on their turf. Well, turnabout is fair play, so On the Media presents NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore as Dirty Harry.
What you doing, you pighead sucker?
Every day for the last 10 years, Loretta there has been giving me a large black coffee. Today, she gives me a large black coffee, only it's got sugar in it. A lot of sugar. I just came back to complain. Now, you boys, put those guns down.
Say what?
Well, we're not just gonna let you walk out of here.
Who's we, sucker?
Smith and Wesson and me. Go ahead, make my day.
Coming up, NBC's new merger and the news, or lack thereof, from Afghanistan.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's a long, troubled Muslim nation reeling in the violent aftermath of war, riven by sectarian rivalries, chaotic and violent despite a heavy presence of U.S. troops. I refer, of course, to Afghanistan, where the Bush administration's war on terror began and where it continues, more in the shadows than ever. Not because clandestine operations are hidden from the press's view, but because the press has largely evaporated. The huge media presence of 2 years ago has dwindled to a handful of foreign correspondents trying gamely to cover an unruly exercise in nation building. Pamela Constable is the Washington Post Afghanistan Bureau, and she joins me now from Kabul. Pam, welcome to OTM.
Well, nice to hear your voice, and happy to be on your show.
So, feeling a little lonely, are we?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, in some ways it's a lot less lonely than it used to be. When I visited here a number of times during the Taliban regime, it was incredibly lonely. You know, I would be staying in a 500-room, completely empty hotel in which I was literally sometimes the only guest. And, you know, I would go out in the streets and not see another Westerner, let alone another woman. Now, Kabul has become a rather busy, bustling, poor, but very exciting place to be, absolutely full of foreigners of all kinds. So if there's anything lonely about it, it's that there isn't, as you point out, as much media presence as there was.
I don't know if you're filing less or what, but you don't seem as prominent in the pages of the Washington Post as you were a couple of years ago, you know, in the heat of the war. But you're still in the paper, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm writing 2-3 stories a week. I'm writing as much as I ever have. In fact, in some ways, it's a better situation because I'm writing more features and less breaking news. The difference, I think, has much more to do with what happens to the stories. There's still a lot of appetite for stories from Afghanistan, but there's much more competition, particularly, you know, with Iraq and the Middle East. And because there's less television coverage here, the news is more sort of driven by what we see happening, what we decide to write about.
In the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan a couple of years ago, I have this vivid image of Peter Jennings standing on a studio floor-sized map of the region, explaining where Afghanistan resides geographically and I guess culturally. And Afghanistan, for, you know, a brief time, was pretty much in the forefront of American thoughts. Do you believe that it is back in the shadows and that to the extent that Americans were aware that it was there, it's just kind of disappeared from their view?
I don't really think so. The United States is spending a heck of a lot of money here every day, and the United States still has thousands of troops here, and they're not leaving anytime soon. I think as long as that remains the case, there will be a lot of interest in what happens here, you know, again, whether or not it's on the evening news every night. You know, again, because the television coverage of this country has dropped off, it makes for less, certainly, American and international awareness of what's going on.
And how about covering the war itself? Most of the fighting is going on along the border with Pakistan, not in Kabul. Is it difficult for you to stay abreast of the developments in the struggle against the holdout Taliban forces?
It is. The difficulty has a lot to do with danger. You know, up until quite recently, reporters and people in general could travel pretty much all over the country. You know, one could drive on the roads, one could, you know, do interviews and sort of stop along the way and chat and, you know, do a sort of normal kind of reporting. Now, because there have been so many attacks on police and aid workers and schools, you know, the so-called soft targets, people are being much more careful now about when and where they travel, how they travel, with whom, in what kind of vehicle. So, yes, I mean, I'm doing a lot of reporting from Kabul. I've made 3 or 4 trips into the countryside, but not the kind of extended trips I used to take when there was less of a risk.
One more question. You've spent the better part of the last 5 years dodging bullets and bandits in the midst of a very interesting ongoing story. But if the foreign editor of the Washington Post were to call you tomorrow and say, hey, Pam, Paris beckons, what would you say?
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm not really the Paris type. if the foreign editor called and said, you know, Johannesburg beckons or Mexico City beckons or Cairo beckons, that might be very tempting. But, you know, I don't know what I would do in Paris. I mean, you know, go sit in cafes and interview, you know, artists or something. It just doesn't have the same same ring of truth somehow.
Well, Pam, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Well, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, come on out. The weather is crisp and cool and fall.
Okay. Keep a light on for me.
All right.
Pamela Constable is the Kabul bureau chief for The Washington Post.
The The confirmation of Utah Governor Mike Leavitt to head the EPA has been blocked in the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee because its Democratic members say they'll boycott the vote. A new vote is slated for next week but could be stalled again, depending on how long the Democrats hold out. Why won't they vote? The confirmation is being held hostage by the senators until they can wring some facts from the White House. First off, New York Senator Hillary Clinton, who wants to know more about the EPA's handling of the cleanup of Lower Manhattan after 9/11. She wants to know more because a report released last August by the EPA's Inspector General says the White House instructed EPA officials to edit cautionary statements out of their press releases and to put more reassuring statements in. It's just one recent indication of what many science researchers and reporters see as an alarming tendency by this White House to channel science fact through a political filter. For instance, a recent study by the House Committee on Government Reform, requested by California Democrat Henry Waxman, charges the Bush administration with playing up the effectiveness of abstinence-only programs and playing down the effectiveness of condoms. It says the White House squelched information related to global warming, as well as data that suggests using antibiotics in hog farming may weaken the effectiveness of such drugs in humans. Paula Park is a senior editor at The Scientist, and she says the Waxman report is certainly partisan, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. She's familiar with the issue of hog farming and antibiotic resistance.
And that, I think, is a very serious charge. There's been some questions as to whether antibiotics used in other livestock as well has led to resistance among diseases that also affect humans, like pneumonia, tuberculosis, and some venereal diseases.
There have been a couple of charges, general charges, that have been leveled at the Bush administration by the scientific community. One is that it manufactures certainty, and another that it manufactures uncertainty. For instance, in the area of condoms to protect against transmission of STDs and HIV, the government, which supports abstinence, has introduced a note of doubt into the ability of condoms to offer sufficient protection. And this has people at the Centers for Disease Control up in arms.
Certainly, the administration has, what some may argue, presented an overblown case of the uncertainty of condoms. Obviously, condoms have proven to be the best possible way of not getting STD through sexual transmission. And what needs to be put out in the public is, you know, valid statistical comparisons between methods of preventing pregnancy and STD, and obviously AIDS, so that people could see, well, okay, there may be an infinitesimal chance with condoms that I might get AIDS, but compare that with everything else, I'm going to go with condoms. That's what should be put out in the public. The Bush administration's policy is criticized because it's almost as if the government wants to tell people what they should do rather than show them information and let them make their own decision.
So do you feel that in the cases we've mentioned, the current administration is interfering with science and misleading the public, as the Waxman report suggests? And if it is it behaving any differently than any other administration?
Yes, I do believe that the administration is managing the information that comes out about science to further its own aims. That is not unusual for administrations to do. The difference with the Bush administration is, with other administrations, it has been in their favor to let more information out about science. Therefore, if the information that was publicized was in some way inaccurate or unbalanced, then the scientists could read it, evaluate it, and comment on it. However, the Bush administration's tendency is to keep back information, to do things behind the scene, so that it's very difficult for scientists to assess its validity. Even if the Bush policymakers were correct, nobody can really make that judgment because they don't have the evidence that the Bush administration is allegedly using.
One of the behind-the-scenes actions of the Bush administration cited in the Waxman report is the manipulation of scientific advisory committees, specifically the appointment of unqualified people with industry ties or ideological agendas. That's what most worries Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine.
I think that the use of political loyalty tests in making appointments has reached almost epidemic proportions, and that concerns me a lot. If you have people with announced political convictions before the fact, I think it's very difficult for the public to trust the judgments they make as to their objectivity. I also think it risks making bad policies. If you have a regulatory agency like the Environmental Protection Agency, you want to be sure that the advice that they get is based on what's the best science, not what's the science that agrees with the conclusion that this administration would like to reach on policy ground.
What will be the early warning signs that this kind of political manipulation of advisory committees is actually having an effect on the quality of information that goes out to the public?
Well, I think it ought to be possible to monitor information that's given in various science agency websites and see whether there are changes. That's probably the best early warning signal that you can get. There's a contrast between what the previous administration said in the CDC website and what this administration changed it to. That's one indication, it seems to me, that's absolutely objective about how much scientific objectivity has been threatened in a new administration. The Center for Disease Control website that spoke to the use of condoms, that spoke to the abortion issue, was quite radically revised during the Bush administration from a previous set of information that, for example, clearly indicated that abortion history doesn't have anything to do with breast cancer liability. The clinical evidence on that is very good. The new website makes it much less clear that abortion history is unrelated to cancer liability. They simply left it so fuzzy that a reasonable reader would conclude that there was a relationship. And so I think the only cure for this is to exert some serious oversight of the process.
What's the likelihood of that happening?
Well, you know, Congress once had an Office of Technology Assessment. It led a very useful life until its disestablishment some years ago.
And in the meantime, what's the public to do?
Keep looking and watching. I think that over time, if this proves to be a chronic problem with the Bush administration, as I fear it may be, then more evidence will accumulate. There will be more coverage in the mainstream media, and people will start asking questions of their congressmen.
Of course, it behooves the public to ask questions and to embrace the caveat emptor school of whatever they read in the press. But I know that you've expressed concern over various polls that suggest the public really has some wildly mistaken scientific views.
Well, I've been concerned with a poll quoted, I think, by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times recently that said that although 80% of the American people believe in the virgin birth, only 26% believe in evolution. I'm not going to go quarrel with anybody about their religious beliefs, but I think it's a little surprising that only a quarter of our citizens believe in the theory of evolution. Strikes me as extraordinary.
So this is a lot bigger problem than merely the manipulation of scientific advisory committees.
I think the problem ultimately has to be resolved through improving the quality of science education.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Donald Kennedy is editor-in-chief of the journal Science.
And now for a few of your letters. Last week, consumer advocate Gary Ruskin explained why he supports on-air disclosure when advertisers pay for product placements on TV shows. Terrence McKenna of Dover, New Jersey, wrote in to say that he thinks Ruskin should, quote, find another gig. A long time ago, consumer advocates like Vance Packard tried to frighten us into believing that we were pawns to any number of sophisticated manipulators, McKenna writes. Yes, we are manipulated, but we are manipulated as much by commentators on Fox as we are by the cereal box we spy in a Seinfeld episode. Every new way of selling seems intriguing and exciting, but equally, as devices become familiar, we become inured to them. Probably as soon as Mr. Ruskin figures out how we've been manipulated, we are becoming bored.
Clark Hoyt, Washington editor of Knight Ridder, writes that my interview with reporter Walter Pincus, quote, left the false impression that the Washington Post was way ahead of other media in fact-checking the Bush administration on the war in Iraq. In the critical period leading up to the war, the Post's coverage mostly reflected official White House and Pentagon views. Pincus wrote on the Post's front page, for example, that intelligence officials believed that Saddam Hussein would be toppled by a coup on the eve of an American invasion. Knight Ridder, the nation's second-largest newspaper company, was virtually alone in reporting that senior military officers and intelligence officials believed the administration was overstating the dangers posed by Saddam, exaggerating his ties to al-Qaeda, and downplaying the dangers of a new war in the Middle East. The Post is a great newspaper, but it was way behind the curve on this story at a time when it could have mattered.
Victor Kress of Seattle, Washington, wrote in to say, add his voice to the, quote, chorus lauding our show. But that's not why I'm writing. I also wanted to express my joy when I went to your website and found that I could download MP3s of the last program. Now that I can download MP3s, I can listen anytime. I'm looking forward to listening while I bike to work in the morning. As far as I'm concerned, your MP3 experiment is a huge success.
Yes, folks, the show is now available in a handy-dandy MP3 format, which you can download from our website at onthemedia.org. You can also email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. But really, it makes us look more credible if you tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, big media get bigger and prompt a big yawn. Also, gossip in the Big Apple.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations, and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Media scholar and social critic Neil Postman died this week of lung cancer at a hospital near his home in Flushing, New York. In his many articles, books, and lectures, Postman was passionate about the impact of television on individuals and society as a whole. He urged people to be skeptical of the rush towards new communications technologies and new technologies in general. OTM's Paul Ingalls presents some of the enduring questions raised by Neil Postman.
The principal legacy of the telegraph, wrote Neil Postman in his 1985 book Amusing Ourselves to Death, was that it generated an abundance of irrelevant information. It could send news across the nation that we could talk about having heard, but very little of the news it spread could lead to any meaningful action. Postman largely felt the same way about television, which presented, he wrote, a peekaboo world, where now this event, now that, pops into view for a moment, then vanishes again. It is a world without much coherence or sense, a world that does not ask us, indeed does not permit us, to do anything. But, like peekaboo, it is also endlessly entertaining. Postman was fond of challenging lecture audiences to critically ask, what problem exactly does a new technology solve? Here he is at a media conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1998, applying the question to a debate over whether or not the U.S. government should subsidize the manufacture of a supersonic transcontinental jet.
And so the question was asked, what is the problem to which the supersonic jet is the solution? The answer, it turned out, was that it takes 6 hours to go from New York to London in a 747. With a supersonic jet, it can be done in 3. Now, most Americans, I'm happy to say, did not think that that was a sufficiently serious problem to warrant such a heavy investment. Besides, some Americans asked, what would we do with the 3 hours we saved? And their answer was, we probably would watch television. And so the suggestion was made that we put television sets on the 747s and thereby save billions of dollars. After one has answered the question, what is the problem to which a particular technology is the solution, one must ask, whose problem is it? In the case of the SST, the problem of getting to London faster than 747s could do it was largely a problem for movie stars, rock musicians, and corporate executives, hardly a problem that most Americans would regard as worth solving if it would cost them a lot of money. But this question, whose problem is it, needs to be applied to any technology. Most technologies do solve some problem, but the problem may not be everybody's problem or even most people's problem. We need to be very careful in determining who will benefit from a technology and who will pay for it. They are not always the same people.
Neil Postman often ran against the grain that suggests that new technologies always lead to progress. He knew some saw him as a Luddite, fearful of all new technologies. But he said he was really only encouraging caution and reflection around our techno-lust. He once wondered, for example, why New York schools were rushing to wire all the classrooms for the Internet when they hadn't enough chairs and desks to accommodate all the students. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
The announcement of NBC's merger with Universal Studios, a transfer of assets from the disintegrating French conglomerate Vivendi to NBC parent General Electric, was the latest blockbuster deal to redraw the map of big media. The news, however, did not seem to particularly rock Wall Street, Madison Avenue, or Hollywood. Nor did the news generate a vast amount of news. Among those bemused by how routine this is all getting is advertising age editor and my boss in my other job, Scott Donatan. Mr. Donatan, sir, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me back, Bob.
So this gigantic merger, and the press seemed to take it with kind of a yawn and a shrug. It barely broke out of the business pages. How could that be?
I think the press tried to get itself excited about it, but it was hard because it's really a big so what. Really, all NBC is doing and all Universal is doing are catching up to everyone else in the media business. It was a deal that kind of had to be done. NBC needed a studio. Universal Vivendi needed a savior for its entertainment properties. This is just a smart, strategic business deal.
So now all four major networks have movie studios attached to them. Now that it is a given in the TV business, does it suggest that networks are truly nervous and uncertain about their future as over-the-air broadcasters?
Well, clearly, Bob, the television industry is undergoing immense change. And if you look at NBC, until this deal, they've been about 95% dependent on advertising revenue in their model. And after this deal, they'll be about 50% dependent on advertising revenue. So clearly, as television audiences fragment, as advertising skipping devices such as TiVo reach critical mass, if you can diversify the businesses you're in, lessen your dependency on advertising, and give yourself a new source of content for your network, it's a good thing.
Okay, so first there was Disney, ABC, and then Fox, 20th Century Fox, CBS, and Paramount, and now NBC and Universal. Clearly, when one network makes an important strategic move, the others are soon to follow. What other domino has fallen out there that we can expect to set other dominoes of falling in the TV business in the coming years?
I think now what you're seeing is this expansion of the number of cable properties owned by these companies. You know, Viacom has an extensive, in addition to CBS, an extensive group of cable networks. And NBC, which had been very slow in getting into the cable business, is now suddenly in it in a much bigger way. ABC with ESPN, among other networks. So I think cable television is growing at a quicker pace than broadcast. The audiences are migrating to these specialty channels. And I think what you'll see is the independent cable networks that are still out there will probably start to get swallowed up by these broadcast behemoths.
And what about satellite television? News Corporation, which owns Fox Broadcasting, has all but cornered the market in direct broadcast satellites around the world. Do you expect these other gigantic media corporations to try to compete in the satellite business as well?
I don't think so. I think Murdoch is the only one right now that has defined that it's important to be in the distribution end of the business as well for television. It's a very European model of what they call vertical integration, of owning the pipeline as well as the content. And I don't think most of these studios and networks feel that they need to be in the distribution end of the game.
It wasn't long ago that AOL Time Warner made big headlines because the whole media landscape was going to change. This doesn't mean that the whole media landscape isn't actually going to change, does it?
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, there was this great fear that we'd consolidate into three or four or five companies, and therefore we would watch only three or four or five TV networks or have only three or four or five magazines. And the truth is that, yes, we are down to a handful of giants that control almost every aspect of the business, but the consumer has more choice than ever. So the fears have kind of gone away with that.
Well, Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Scott Donatan is editor of Advertising Age. He spoke to us from his office in New York.
No, it's not the city of big shoulders nor brotherly love, and it sure ain't the city of angels. It's where politics and media, real estate and Wall Street, Broadway and Soho, J-Lo and De Niro, Rudy, Rosie, Bubba, and a galaxy of distant worlds all collide into one dazzling 24-hour explosion of gossip. New York City, gossip capital, the gossip columnist's dream, you'd think.
I'm having trouble sleeping. There's tightness in my chest. I hope I'm not having a heart attack.
Lloyd Grove is the brand new gossip columnist for the New York Daily News, recently transplanted from the Washington Post. We first spoke to him just before he launched his column.
I feel like I'm actually scaling a vertical sheet of ice and hoping that I don't go falling off into the abyss.
No one at the bottom holding a trampoline?
Not in New York.
The thing is, New York has the most gossip, but it also has the most gossip columnists. The competition is fierce.
The premier gossip column is Page Six. It's in the New York Post, and it's headed by Richard Johnson, but it's written by a team of writers, and it is really the first place that people go.
MSNBC gossip columnist Jeanette Wells.
In addition to that, we also have in the New York Post Cindy Adams, who's sort of a dragon lady of gossip, and then we have Liz Smith, who's sort of the doyenne, the good old gal of gossip. Then at the Daily News, we have Rushen and Malloy, a husband and wife team. They tend to specialize in celebrity stuff, but they often get mover and shaker type items as well. And now we have Lloyd's column as well. And then in the New York Times, they've also added a gossip column. It's called Boldface Names, which they don't like to call gossip because the New York Times pretends it doesn't do gossip. But that's how competitive the scene is right now.
Most New York gossip scribes work their way up, but Grove arrived full-grown from Washington, where he had gossip dominance. His move spurred a page one feature in the New York Times, the AP, and even a little mention in the International Herald Tribune. When the city's dominant column, the Post's page six, ran an item on him, Grove called one of the writers seeking a correction and...
Then he said, "We will send you back to Washington on a stretcher." Now, I'm told that the New York Times reporter called him to verify the quote, and he did verify that he'd said it. But he said, "You know, if I'd been thinking more clearly, I would have said, send him back to Washington in a body bag."
Yeah, I was a little surprised by the reaction that Lloyd got.
George Rush is one half of the husband and wife gossip writing team, Rush and Malloy.
It just seemed like Gangs of New York, where there were so many back alley boys who suddenly blew snuff into his face and started to pick his pocket. I think it bespeaks a nervousness on the part of his assassins that they do recognize that he's probably a better stylist as a writer than they are, and he may not go down as easily as some of the others have in the past.
Yes, others have failed, even at the Daily News. But Grove's column, called Lowdown, is up and running with items about a very short actor cruising a very tall model, a quote from Boy George that he's brighter than he looks, and a pungent airing of some famous dirty laundry.
There's little question that the best item that we had so far was Kerry Kennedy Cuomo going off on Uber publicist Dan Cloris, who's a close friend and advisor of her estranged husband, Andrew, at Michael's, which is the media watering hole in New York. And it was just sort of, what could be more human than an estranged wife going up to the friend of her husband, who she thinks has wronged her in a public place, and reading him the riot act? I mean, that's something that everybody can relate to. That's the sweet spot of a gossip column.
Ah, the sweet spot, enduring as a snowflake. As the founding father of newspaper gossip, Walter Winchell, once put it, nothing recedes like success. In fact, that's the seductive power of gossip.
It levels the playing field.
Neil Gabler is the author of Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity.
It takes the wealthy, the powerful, the famous, and by puncturing their veil of wealth, power, and fame, it brings them down to the level of the reader. There was a line by Leonard Lyons, the old gossip columnist, who said that gossip either takes them down or rises us up. Whatever the transaction is, I certainly think there's a very strong democratizing component to it.
And so it has endured from Winchell's mid-century heyday, with one crucial difference. Back then, the big shots were Winchell and Dorothy Kilgallen and Ed Sullivan, who started out as a gossip columnist. The celebrities were the supplicants, plying their wares through press agents who served as courtiers in the columnists' courts. Now the columnists are the courtiers, fed juicy tidbits by publicists at the convenience of the stars.
When people were willing to out themselves, when people were willing to control their own narrative, and gossip columnists lost the power to control that narrative, that game was finished. It was a different game after that.
Recently, the Association of Theatrical Press Agents and Managers celebrated their 75th anniversary at a Broadway restaurant festooned with pictures of artists long faded or dead. Merle Dubusky is a senior member, and he remembers the days when Winchell reigned unchallenged at the Daily Mirror, a populist figure who struck fear in the hearts of the mighty.
When a number one most wanted criminal was turning himself in, didn't turn him into J. Edgar Hoover, turned himself into Walter Winchell. Well, can't you see Gotti or somebody turning himself into Cindy Adams today? It was a big difference.
When the power began to shift, the diminished Winchell was shunned for red-baiting and reduced to printing up his own columns and haunting his old watering holes. He was savaged in the 1957 movie The Sweet Smell of Success, the saga of a power-mad gossip columnist and his sleazy press agent flunky.
Burt Lancaster as J.J. Hunsaker, world-famed columnist whose gossip is gospel to 60 million readers. Tony Curtis as Sidney Falco, the kid who had ideas about taking over.
But we happen to know I'm your star pupil, because I reflect back to you your own talent.
I'd hate to take a bite of you. You're a cookie full of arsenic.
Merle Dubusky attended a special premiere for press agents in 57 and encountered the enraged model for Hunsaker outside.
And when we left, on the corner, with his foot up on the fire plug, was Walter Winchell, sneering at us. You dumb guys, don't you know when you're getting slandered? What are you crazy guys? Don't you have any pride? Stuff like that. He missed the point, I think.
The point is that everyone has their role to play, and no one is above nasty media portrayals, not least the practitioners themselves. The role of the gossip columnist is to tattletale on the fabulous without getting sued. To that end, they developed a particular vocabulary.
Canoodling is a useful word in that no one quite knows what it means, except that it does suggest some sort of romantic nuzzle.
George Rush.
It's a sort of libel-conscious word that, because it can't be precisely defined, it's not necessarily actionable. It's like a throwback to one of my favorite phrases from the Winchell era, where the code word would be that two people had become fast friends and dancing partners. And it's good when you can't quite establish what went on in the bathroom after someone closed the door.
Give us enough about the squalid doings behind that bathroom door, and we're bound to feel better about ourselves. Nobody can intimidate us anymore. Not celebrities, not even fellow gossip columnists with the long knives for the new guy, Lloyd Grove.
I mean, it might be offensive to some in New York to hear this, but I'm afraid you're not that special. You're just people, and I am not awed by you. You know, you're just fodder, grist to the mill, as far as I'm concerned.
Can you imagine the new guy in Chicago saying that to Chicagoans? Nah. In the words of that durable sage, Cindy Adams, only in New York, kids. Only in New York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.